This podcast is from the Rand Corporation, a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. For more Rand analysis, reports, and commentary on issues at the forefront of today's policy debate, visit www.rand.org.
Today we'll be hearing from Ambassador Jim Dobbins, who just came running off an airplane. We're lucky he got here in time. Laurel Miller and Keith Crane on their recent report, Building a More Resilient Haitian State. As you know, Haiti suffered a catastrophic earthquake in January of this year, leaving hundreds of thousands dead and injured and over a million homeless. In the wake of this natural disaster, we can now see the weakness in the institutional capability and strength of the infrastructure. This report focuses on assisting Haiti and the international community to set priorities and provide achievable goals. To that end, this report focuses on key areas, governance and public administration, justice and security, economic policy and infrastructure, education and health care, and donor cooperation. I'll turn it over to Ambassador Dobbins.
Thank you, Shirley. In the mid-90s, I was the Clinton administration's envoy for Haiti. And in the aftermath of January's earthquake, it struck me that we ought to try to avoid making some of the mistakes we made in the 1990s. One of the impulses for this project was precisely to try to put forward proposals that would steer us away from some of those mistakes. Among the mistakes we made in the 1990s was thinking we could fix Haiti in 2 years. President Clinton went in 1994, leading an international intervention and a promise that he would be out within 2 years, a promise he kept, but a promise that ultimately meant that whatever we'd been able to achieve during that brief period eroded rather rapidly, requiring that American troops go back into Haiti in 2004 under President Bush. A second mistake I think we made back then was to think that you could fix Haiti on an aid budget of about $100 million a year, which was pretty much the average throughout the 1990s. And a third was having a strategy that focused almost exclusively on building the police on the one hand and privatizing inefficient Haitian state companies. Fixing the police was, of course, a good idea, but we failed to parallel that with equal efforts to fix the courts and the penal system and the rest of the government. And the result is that once we left, the police rapidly receded back to the general level of corruption and incompetence of the government as a whole. And similarly, focusing almost exclusively in our economic strategy on privatizing state companies, focused on what was, it turned out to be, the hardest possible political task. And I think the World Bank and others have discovered that that given the unwillingness of poor, mismanaged societies to give up what few national assets they have in that manner, means that this probably isn't a good place to start, no matter how much economic sense it makes. Now, the second impulse for this was a series of studies that we've done at RAND, Keith and I and some other colleagues on state building. Our assessment of Haiti and the reason and the earthquake is that the fundamental flaw was not bad building codes or even a flaw in the Earth's crust. It was the incapacity of the Haitian government to prepare for national disasters and to respond to them when they come. Given where Haiti's located, it's always going to have hurricanes. Given where Port-au-Prince is located, it's also going to have occasional earthquakes. And anything we do now to fix the results of this latest disaster will be undone just as quickly the next time one of these strikes, unless we fix that underlying problem. So we've done six volumes of studies on state building or nation building, whichever you prefer, at RAND over the last 6 or 7 years, looking at 22 different cases in which the international community, the U.S., the U.N., or the Europeans tried to fix a failing or failed state. And we thought that some of those lessons could be usefully applied in Haiti, and this was the other source of inspiration for our study. I'm going to ask one of my colleagues, Oral Miller, to lead off the briefing, and then Keith will take over, and then all three of us will be ready to answer questions.
Jim mentioned some of the ways in which the earthquake revealed underlying weaknesses in Haiti in terms of governance and in terms of the institutions of the state there. Looking forward towards recovery in Haiti, we can actually see that the country has some natural advantages to draw on. Unlike other fragile states around the world, it's not part of a troubled region with unhelpful neighbors. There are no deep ethnic or other structural divides in the society, other than severe income inequality. There's a large, skilled, economically successful diaspora in North America that's quite supportive of the country. And as many of you probably know, Haiti has preferential access to U.S. markets and in light of U.S. trade legislation. Moreover, in recent years, there have actually been a number of important, though fragile, improvements in Haiti. In the last 5 years, there's been modest economic growth, there's been an increase in political stability, and there have actually been some improvements in public administration. And while these improvements and this progress has been modest and was clearly vulnerable to the devastation that we saw during the earthquake, it does give reason to see that that progress is possible in Haiti despite the country's many problems. Nevertheless, in our study, we found that Haiti's government has, for the most part, been unable to capitalize on these advantages. They haven't been able to develop and to implement realistic plans and policies for reform and for poverty alleviation. Our study was an effort to try to help address that strategic planning gap in Haiti. We looked at really all of the reform plans that have been put in place there since 2004 when there was a change in government, and we drew on those plans and our analysis of those plans to propose a set of recommendations for how Haiti can move forward. We sought to identify steps that would be actually achievable, that would be fiscally sustainable by the Haitian government over the long term, and that would be a mutually coherent set of objectives. If there's one overarching recommendation that we have in our study, it's that there's a real need to prioritize in Haiti, that a smaller number of more focused goals and objectives and plans drawn up to achieve those objectives has a better chance of being realized than the very ambitious, broad-ranging plans that are in place now and the very ambitious objectives. So we focused on several key areas in our analysis, and we're going to go through some of the highlights of the challenges that we identified in each area and the recommendations that we have. Looking first at governance and public administration, there are a number of problems that we identified. Key among them, the limited financial resources of the Haitian state, lack of human resources, lack of skilled professionals who are properly organized to run a government, and lack of management systems throughout the government. Some of the changes that are needed are going to require both legislative changes and also constitutional changes, and this points to the need for better functioning political institutions in Haiti as well as a better functioning bureaucracy. Among all of the needs that we identified, we think that civil service reform really deserves the very highest priority in Haiti. Moreover, donors should, including the U.S. government as well as other bilateral donors and the multilateral institutions, really need to place a higher priority on public administration reform. It's fundamental to every aspect of state building and strengthening state institutions in Haiti, but it's actually an area that's received relatively little attention. Donors also need to use their influence to promote political reforms in Haiti in order to enable progress. Justice and security are two additional areas that we looked at. The justice system has weaknesses in pretty much any area that you can imagine. A lack of management systems, lack of understanding of the laws by judges and lawyers and actual application of the laws, horrible prison conditions throughout the country, an increase in property-related disputes after the earthquake. There have been a number of efforts funded, among others, by the U.S. government since the mid-1990s to try to address these issues, but they've borne very little fruit to date. We think that eventually there's going to need to be thoroughgoing reform in the justice system if you're going to have a really functioning system. But in the near term that we're focused on in our report, near term being the next 3 to 5 years, we think that a select number of reforms in a few key areas could really make a difference, and that if efforts are focused in a few areas rather than trying to reform the entire system all at once, there's a better chance of actually making some improvements. And some of the areas that we have recommended focusing on are to put in place a comprehensive system for managing cases, managing legal cases from arrest through detention, putting in place a special mechanism for reviewing the huge problem that they have of pretrial detainees who've been in prolonged detention without ever seeing judges, putting in place a property dispute resolution mechanism, and going along with that, improving systems for registering births, deaths, and providing identity cards for people. In security, there's actually been considerable improvement relative to other areas in developing the Haitian National Police. There have been improvements in recruiting and training and vetting police personnel. Nevertheless, while there has been measurable progress in this area, the Haitian National Police is still unable to respond to Haiti's internal security threats without outside assistance. So we think that the Haitian government and the international community need to keep security at the top of the reform agenda, because without maintaining security, there really won't be the preconditions in place for recovery. Along those lines, we think that UN peacekeepers are going to need to stay in the country for at least the next 5 years, and then ultimately when they're withdrawn, to do that only gradually. And meanwhile, the administrative capabilities of the Haitian National Police need to be strengthened so that this is really a sustainable institution over the long term. With that, I'm going to turn over to Keith.
I focused on the economic and infrastructure facets of what needs to be done in Haiti.
As you well know, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Much of this is self-inflicted. Haiti has some of the most challenging obstacles to creating a business and conducting economic activity of any place. It costs twice as much or three times as much to take a container into Port-au-Prince than it does in the Port of L.A., where we have much higher living standards. So our focus was, in terms of the recommendations, was to say what could be done quickly and effectively to improve the economic situation in Haiti. Haiti does need to raise taxes, but it has a whole plethora of taxes that span a gamut of different economic activities, which actually impede economic activities. So we said what needs to be done is the Haitian government with the donor community needs to sit down and focus on which of those taxes are nuisance taxes, taxes specifically designed to have bureaucrats put their hand out and ask for bribes so people don't have to pay them, and then focus on value-added tax and property taxes to generate more income in the future. In addition to that, first and foremost, I would argue, is they need to focus on what needs to be done to reduce all these different restrictions on business activities. For example, in property tax, property transactions, a notary charges 6 to 7% of the value of the transaction. It takes well over a year to complete those transfer of ownership from one to another. And obviously, people, you know, life goes on, so people either ignore those activities, or they end up paying bribes, or they just don't take place. So our focus here was is that we need to sit down. USAID has a program already to do one-stop shopping for business registration, but to move forward with that, to work with the Haitian government, to go through those different procedures and eliminate those which are useless and then shorten those which are needed. We then asked the question of what to do about housing infrastructure. Laurel focused on civil administration reform. In addition to that, we would argue that the key challenge to the Haitian government at this point in time is to create housing. We dodged a bullet this year with the hurricane season. Fortunately, Haiti did not have the tent camps were not inundated by a hurricane. This may not happen next year, so things need to move quickly in order to create some sort of more permanent housing by the time the hurricane season hits next year. In addition to that, people can list all the problems with electric power and roads, et cetera, but money has been put in those in the past, so we said, yes, those are important, but it's silly to put money into building those things unless you have a maintenance plan to make sure that they're going to be working in the future. So our recommendations here was, first, you can't build housing in Port-au-Prince until you clear out the rubble. And the number one priority in terms of infrastructure is to get the rubble out quickly. We've got, you know, now it's only 10 months, 9 months before hurricane season number two comes through. Time to get that rubble out as quickly as possible. After World War II, which many people have compared Port-au-Prince, the devastation there, to that which took place in Berlin and Dresden and Warsaw after World War II. But the first thing people did after World War II was get out there and start clearing the bricks. And this is something that the international community with the Haitian government can really push forward now, because until there's a place to build, people aren't going to build again. In addition to that, we focus on, in the infrastructure area, was to really get systems in place and or to eliminate restrictions. So in the case of ports, in the past, Haiti has practiced a monopoly of ports, which explain these very high costs of importing and exporting. Haiti is a very small, open economy. Most things that people consume are imported. The way they pay for that is through exports. So the best way in order to improve living standards is to reduce those costs, and here, by reducing restrictions in terms of private ports and encouraging the private sector to invest, we would argue that's probably the most important thing one could do to raise living standards. Finally, Haiti has two electric power systems. One is private generators up in the hills, people little gasoline generators. Cost of electricity runs close to $1 a kilowatt hour if you buy a little gasoline generator. That's about 10 times what I pay in Virginia. Then there's a state-run sector, which now costs 13% of this of the funds the Haitian government collects every year, goes out as subsidies to electric power, which goes to people who are better off, people with connections, or people who steal it. And there are the focus there should be in terms of moving to full cost recovery pricing, so that you can continue to buy fuel oil to keep those generators going. And then secondly is to focus on creating a billing system and collection system whereby the system will be self-sustainable by getting enough money to keep operating the system. We also looked at education and health care. Haiti is unusual in terms of countries in the world. There's only about four or five countries in the world where most children who do go to school are educated not by the state, but by either churches or charities or for-profit schools. And so the government is not the chief provider. And unfortunately, many of these schools are of poor quality, especially some of those that are for-profit. And education is relatively expensive. It's one of the biggest items in the budgets of Haitians. And as a consequence, kids go in and out of school depending on whether the parents have enough money to pay for education. So our recommendations there was to say, Haitian government's not going to be in any position to create a public system of education anytime soon. So in the next 3 or 4 years, what they need to do is build on what's there. The focus then should be on encouraging the Ministry of Education to look at adopt a regulatory role. That is, that they would go out and make sure that the schools that do exist meet a certain minimal standard, and that and the focus should be on closing the gaps between the poorer schools and the better schools. We would argue by subsidizing salaries of teachers in exchange for ensuring that the quality of education in those schools meet minimal standards. Challenges in healthcare are also somewhat similar. Again, the number of individuals in Haiti who receive public health care is very small. Very large numbers of Haitians, 40%, actually have no access to public health care or very little access to any health care at all. They use traditional medicine or have to come into Port-au-Prince at very high cost in order to get some sort of treatment. So our focus here, again, is not to actually have the state provide that service. In fact, we would argue that what limited services the state does provide today should actually be turned over to non-governmental operators. These can be anything from churches and charities to non-profit hospitals or even for-profit operators. And the focus of the Ministry of Health then should again be to focus on providing a minimal level of quality and try to expand universal access either through subsidies or through public vaccination programs or working with the NGO and private sector to make sure that there is greater access to health care. In addition to those types of services that the government is trying to provide, they should use performance-based contracting and contract it out to providers who are in country right now and doing a better job than the government. Finally, we talked a little bit about donor coordination. Haiti has had some very substantial influxes of foreign assistance in the past. As you can see, it goes up and down, part in terms of donor interest and part in terms of what's happening in Haiti. What is the problem here is not only has there not been a steady inflow of foreign assistance that people can count on, is that everybody and his brother and sister are going into Haiti right now to try to provide some sort of assistance there without any type of coordination. In fact, Haiti is often deemed the republic of non-governmental organizations. There's so many different actors going on there. And so our focus here was to say, let's use this new, these new organizations, the IHRC, to really make people sit down and knock some heads and make sure that they're focused on providing a coordinated set of assistance programs that have been accepted and discussed with the Haitian government. And then in the context of the IHRC, they actually discuss and modify and make sure that the plans and projects that people have fit into kind of a coherent package. We also would argue that donors, especially the United States, as being one of the lead donors, should really support this multi-donor trust fund. Right now, if you talk to a minister or we talk to the head of police when we were in Haiti, they're spending much of their day talking to different donors, be they from Norway, Canada, the United States, France, Venezuela, Brazil, instead of really focusing on how they should run their departments or their ministries. By channeling more monies through the multi-donor trust fund, what you do is kind of, in essence, providing one-stop shopping for the ministry. That is, that you have really primarily one interlocutor where you can discuss programs and make decisions on where contributions should go. We encourage non-governmental organizations to get involved in that. Instead of being outside the donor community, they really need to get inside. For example, there's a little town up on the border with Dominican Republic. Someone sometime put a clinic up there. It's about maybe 30, 40 kilometers from Port-au-Prince, but it's all by foot, so it's about a day and a half for a lot of people to get up there. The clinic was staffed with and stocked with all sorts of medications and some equipment that could not be used up there. It all went for naught. There was maybe someone there for 6-7 months, and then the clinic closed. And it's this type of activity where people put money and effort into creating an institution. It really needs to be linked both with the national government and the rest of the donor community to make sure it has legs and will continue to survive instead of being dependent on whether one NGO continues to have the effort, take the effort and have the resources to continue it. Finally, we would argue that the major donors, including the United States, should create kind of a contact group or a Friends of Haiti group, which would be focused on having a concerted effort to engage with the government of Haiti to make sure that that the Haitian government also is making progress towards trying to utilize these resources effectively and make some of the tough decisions that it has avoided in the past. So without more ado, we'll turn it over to questions.
This presentation is provided as a public service by the RAND Corporation. Visit www.rand.org to learn more about these issues and to explore RAND's free online library of more than 10,000 policy reports and commentaries.